Away with Words, Part 3, Lecture 12. Phrases and Clauses, Word Choices and Pauses.
This lecture is entitled Phrases and Clauses, Word Choices and Pauses. So we've really built up quite a body of grammatical knowledge by now. After those last two complicated and difficult lectures on transformational generative grammar, you pretty much know more about grammar than the vast, vast majority of people who speak English. You were already there. But now you know more about grammar than the vast, vast majority, I am embarrassed to say this, but it's true, of English professors. Or at least more than the majority of English professors. But even with all of this knowledge, we are only now just about ready to talk about an aspect of grammar that bedevils many, many people, and that is punctuation. But that's the subject of Lecture 13. We're not ready for punctuation yet. You're almost ready, but not quite. In order for punctuation rules to make sense, we have to do a little more work with some of the parts of sentences that are larger than words, but smaller than whole sentences. And these are phrases and clauses. Then we need to talk about how we join whole sentences together and how to put one sentence inside of another sentence. We did some of that in the previous lecture when we talked about nominalization transformations and how you can take a sentence and stick it into a noun phrase. And here we're going to build that all together and build it out into the more practical things that people do all the time. But now you'll understand why they work the way they do. When all this comes together, we will pretty much have all of English grammar down. And we'll also have an understanding of why the rules for sentence organization and punctuation are what they are. We're going to start with phrases. Now, we've been bringing phrases up in the previous sentence when we had phrase structure rules and noun phrases and verb phrases and prepositional phrases, but we never really defined them. This is also part of my teaching approach, is sometimes we just do stuff with things and then we give the definition for it, because then you know really intuitively what the things are. So, the traditional old-school definition of a phrase is a group of grammatically related words that does not have a subject or a predicate, and which operates as a single grammatical unit, as if the phrase itself were a part of speech. That's a reasonable definition, but like a lot of old-school definitions, it explains things in terms of what they're not, rather than in terms of what they are, and that can be confusing. So let's turn to generative grammar for a second, where a phrase is just a subunit of the sentence. This fits with that old school definition that a phrase doesn't have both a subject and a predicate. If it did, it would be a sentence. So a phrase is a subunit of a sentence. It's either a noun phrase, which is a noun plus other stuff, or a verb phrase, which is a verb plus other stuff, or an adjective phrase, which is an adjective plus other stuff, but actually an adjective plus a noun phrase, or a prepositional phrase, which is a preposition plus other stuff, but really a preposition plus another noun phrase. The key point about these phrases, and this is dealt with by both old school and transformational grammar, is that they act like a single part of speech, rather than the way their individual words act. They're bundled in a certain way. So if you have the adjective phrase, a very small, reddish-brown, black-nosed, perky-eared, big, long adjective phrase, right? You can treat that as one single adjective. Grammatically, I mean, you can treat that as one single adjective. So you can move it around like an adjective. You can modify it like one adjective. You can just pick the whole thing up and move it around. That's the beauty of the transformational system. When you have something like noun phrase, boom, it goes in a slot, you just treat it like a noun phrase. You don't have to worry about what's inside it. You can move a noun phrase here, you can move it there. You can shift it around, you can put it underneath something, but you don't have to worry about what the content of that noun phrase is. That's one of the key points, and this is what's helpful for us with phrases. Now, phrase structure rules that we've talked about and the way we rearrange phrases are relevant for our discussion of punctuation. Because when we're trying to put commas into sentences in the right places, we want to use the boundaries of different types of phrases to tell us where the commas do or don't go. So we need to understand what these boundaries are and look at the subunits of sentences that are larger than words, those are phrases, and that are smaller than sentences but larger than phrases. And those are clauses. So picture the hierarchy here. The very bottom are the words. Next up are the phrases, little groups of words. Next up are the clauses, sometimes bigger groups, but more importantly, groups that have certain parts. And then finally, we have sentences where they're all put together. Sentence has a noun phrase and a verb phrase. So let's look at clauses now. There are two kinds of clauses in old school grammar, and these are called independent clauses and dependent clauses, though pretty much everyone pronounces that second one as dependent clauses. Makes me think it has something to do with adult diapers or something, the dependent clauses. But seriously, that's how people pronounce it, just to get the separation there. It's another one of these annoying pairs of words like transitive, intransitive, that people get confused. They know there's two, but they're not sure which one is which. But I don't really have a better set of terms. I mean, if it were up to me, I'd call them standalone clauses and dependent or joined clauses or something. But if I do that, and then you go and read another grammar book, you'll wonder what I'm talking about. I mean, that's why we're stuck with the nomenclature. It's the same reason that when I wrote my Anglo-Saxon grammar book, I had to use strong verb and weak verb and strong noun and weak noun and strong adjective and weak adjective and confuse the heck out of the students, because those different strong and weaks are all about different stuff. That's what happens when you have to inherit other people's nomenclature. It's why naming things is really important. Now, the distinction between independent and dependent clauses is very important for some of the rules of punctuation. And it's also important for determining whether we use which or that to introduce a relative clause. And as this turns out to be another one of these grammar pedantry problems, and also something that people genuinely worry about, we're going to have to build up our knowledge of the different kinds of clauses so that we can explain how this works. So an independent clause, as the name implies, could be, if it had to, a whole sentence on its own. So the independent clause, according to our rules, has to have at least what? A noun phrase and a verb phrase. That makes it independent. It could go out and be a sentence by itself. It's, I'm independent. I can do what I want. A dependent clause would not work as its own sentence. It depends, hence the name, on some other independent clause in the sentence. And often these things are called the main clause. That's the independent one that can be by itself, and a subordinate clause. This is easier to understand. We have some examples, so let's build those up. We'll make some sentences up and talk about red pandas, because that just seems to be what we do, and see how these clauses work. Although Christy was disappointed in the red panda's appearance, she thought it was a cute animal. There are two clauses in this sentence. The first is, although Christy was disappointed in the red panda's appearance. And the second clause is, she thought it was a cute animal. Okay, which one is independent and which one is dependent? Dependent. Let's try them out as standalone sentences. This is the old school way. And quickly find out that the one beginning with although cannot stand on its own. Although Christy was disappointed in the red panda's appearance. She thought it was a cute animal. Ding, 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 ding. Correct. She thought it was a cute animal is a perfectly fine sentence on its own. Let's try another. When the red panda saw us, it turned over and started to snore. When the red panda saw us, not a sentence. It turned over and started to snore. Ding, 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 ding. Very good. Correct. So far, so good. You can see which ones are dependent and which are independent. Now let's take a more complicated example. The red panda, which was sleeping on the branch, had a black nose. Now look, we can't just grab whole clauses there. Instead, we have to take the sentence apart and then re-stitch the clauses together. So we have this clause, which was sleeping on the branch. Can that stand on its own? No. Is it even a clause? Does it have a subject and a predicate, or a noun phrase and a verb phrase? Let's look at it again. Which was sleeping on the branch? Yes, it does. The noun phrase is just which. It's a pronoun. Remember, a noun phrase can be just a pronoun if we need it. And the verb phrase is was sleeping on the branch. So it's a clause. And it's also obvious that it cannot stand on its own because it starts with a relative pronoun, which. And that means, to go back to our transformations, it's been nominalized. You had a sentence, the red panda was sleeping on the branch, and you applied a transformation to make it which was sleeping on the branch. And this is a complicated one because there's insertion. I'm not going to go through the whole transformation, but the basic idea is that the basic idea, it's been changed from a sentence to something that can fit inside of a sentence. And to make this match up with our terminology, it's been changed from an independent clause to a dependent clause. The independent clause, then, for this sentence is made up of the noun phrase at the very beginning of that complex sentence, the red panda, and the verb phrase at the end, had a black nose. So picture what happened here. Try to picture a tree diagram. You've got a sentence that's splitting into a noun phrase and a verb phrase. That's your sentence. And then what you've done is you've pulled those noun phrases and verb phrases apart, and you've stuck a new sentence underneath there. And just to make sure it can fit, it can follow the rules, you've put that which in front of it and done that transformation. So you've got start of a sentence with a noun phrase, whole other sentence under the which, and then conclusion of the sentence. That's what's going on in that complex sentence there. Now, as you can see by the fact that we described this pretty easily with generative grammar, this is one of the things that generative grammar is good at. And actually, it's one of the things that old school grammar and old school diagramming is terrible at. You try to diagram this sentence out using the old school branching diagrams that I learned in eighth grade, and you will have a fairly large and complicated mess. You do this with tree diagrams, and boom, it's right there. It's really clear. By the way, these kinds of sentences, with other kind of pseudo sentences, half sentences, dependent clauses embedded in them, are traditionally called complex sentences. We make a distinction between complex sentences and compound sentences. Compound sentences are basically just sentences right next to each other, joined along by things like and, but, or, nor, for, yet. One sentence and another and another and another. The complex sentences are embedded within each other. And interestingly enough, generative grammar handles complex sentences very, very easily, while old school has problems with them, which is why they call them complex, and both handle compound sentences pretty well. Now, we're going to talk more about compound sentences in the next lecture, and we're going to focus on complex sentences for the rest of this lecture. And this will actually show off another advantage of generative grammar in the way that it's going to make these complex sentences very easy. Now, of course, all this material about complex sentences and clauses, it's all interesting in its own right, but it's also practical in application. Understanding the clause structure gives us the background to understand the mysteries of commas, those little tiny bits of punctuation that terrify people. The relationships between the clauses and the sentences and the different types of clauses explains why we put our commas where we put them, and it also explains why we have to use that sometimes, and other times we have to use which. And this enigma is perhaps as great, if not greater, than the mysteries of I and me, or who and whom. This is also a chance to make fun of one of my colleagues. So I like this colleague, but I will keep his identity. I will keep the colleague's identity secret. I have to admit that I have had more battles about which and that with other faculty members than I care to remember, and certainly more than about any other grammatical issue. We have this one member of the faculty who shall remain nameless. I will say, very, very good teacher, very, very nice person. But I think he's mentally disturbed about this particular issue. He seems unable, in casual conversation, the floor of the faculty meeting, the faculty dining room, to let an incorrectly, in his view, used which or that go by without making some kind of correction. By the way, these corrections are not always right. Need I add that this person is not an English professor? This is a professor in some other discipline. But to him, the distinction between which and that is what separates the barbarians from everyone else. And I can't believe that the English department doesn't teach this. Now, I actually can't believe that the English department doesn't teach this either, we should. It's something that if someone comes out of college with an English degree, they should be just, at any effort, be able to say, of course, use which for this, use that for that. But that's not what life is. They haven't necessarily had the benefit of listening to this course or taking a grammar course from me. So you have to understand people don't understand it, and then you explain it to them. But the distinction between which and that is one of the ways that grammatical insiders keep the interlopers in their place. So what we're going to do is learn the rule and the reasons behind the rule, and then we will give these unnecessarily pedantic folks a dose of their own medicine if they try to correct us. We have to go back to our distinction between independent and dependent clauses. Remember, independent clauses can stand on their own. Dependent clauses cannot. In generative grammar terms, the dependent clauses have been nominalized. They've been turned into a unit inside a sentence. Now, we got to extend this analysis a little bit further and come up with two more descriptions of clauses. And these are restrictive and non-restrictive. And yes, another annoying parallel that people can't keep straight. Which one's the restrictive and which is the non-restrictive? It's not entirely obvious, though it will be clear to you in a moment. Restrictive clauses are akin to independent clauses in that a restrictive clause is absolutely necessary for the meaning of the sentence. So, unfortunately, we're moving away from pure grammar, abstracted grammar, and now we have to look at the sentence for its meaning. Makes it harder. Notice I try to avoid doing that, probably because looking for meaning is what I do all the rest of my time, so I don't want to do it when I'm doing grammar. But we have to look for meaning. Restrictive clauses give meaning that is absolutely necessary for the sentence to have any meaning, and non-restrictive give additional information, but not essential information. They're kind of like dependent clauses. You can take out a non-restrictive clause. That's how I remember it. You're not restricted from taking it out. You can take it out and remove it, and the sentence is still fundamentally the same. By the way, you usually separate these things off from the sentence by commas, but we'll talk more about commas later. So far, so good. But again, we're not only talking about grammaticality, but we're talking about meaning, and that's what makes things trickier. The simple rule for using which versus that is this. All restrictive clauses, ones that can't leave, ones that we need, are introduced by that. And all non-restrictive clauses, the ones that you could take away if you had to, are introduced by which, or in the case of clauses about people, are introduced by who. So, obviously, our key problem is simply going to be to identify restrictive versus non-restrictive clauses, and then put which or that. This is not a big problem when we're using a grammar book and they're there right in front of us because, duh, we look for the commas around the non-restrictive clauses and then we can take them out. If there's no commas around it, we use that. If there are commas, we use which. But the only time this is ever going to help you is if you're correcting someone else's work. And how often are you going to do that? Though perhaps after you are an alumna or an alumnus of this course, you will go around correcting other people's work, though I hope you'll do it following the drought way. But that approach of looking for the commas is not terribly useful when it's your own work and you're writing and you're deciding where to put the commas or not and whether to put in which or that. Here's where generative grammar can help a little, but not as much as in other places. Because remember, generative grammar is about the grammaticality, not the meaning, and this problem is about the meaning. And making judgments based on the meaning is not entirely helped by generative grammar. So what do we do? First, when we're writing, we identify a relative clause. The red panda, blank, was sleeping, was very cute. So we need either the red panda that was sleeping or the red panda which was sleeping was very cute. The relative clause we want to write then is something was sleeping. We need to know if it's restrictive or non-restrictive. So here's the problem. Let's write the sentence and take the clause out and see what happens. The red panda, which was sleeping, was very cute. Take out the which was sleeping. The red panda was very cute. Okay, sounds pretty non-restrictive, right? You're just saying the panda was cute. Here's the problem, and the problem comes in the meaning. The red panda that was sleeping was very cute. Oh, that works too. Both sentences are grammatical, but they're conveying different sorts of information. In the first case, the red panda, which was sleeping, was very cute. There's one red panda. He's sleeping. He's cute. That's non-restrictive. He's the only one, and the relative clause about him isn't essential to the meaning of the sentence. Okay, it's useful information, not essential information. That's the problem. This is a judgment call. But in the second sentence, the red panda that was sleeping was very cute. There are 6 red pandas. They're all lying on branches. Most of them are very ugly. Just the one that's sleeping happens to be the cute one. That clause, then, is restrictive. If you take that information away, you lose the whole meaning of the sentence, which is that only one of the pandas, the sleeping one, is the cute one. And so you don't comma it off, and you don't use which. And see, this is where it gets difficult. In fact, I freely admit it gets difficult, because the pure abstract rules have taken us as far as they can. And now we have to exercise judgment. And boy, doesn't that stink, exercising judgment. That's a lot of work. There may be times when your judgment about the sentence differs from mine. At those times, I am right and you are wrong. Kidding, kidding. Now let's see if the generative grammar rules even help us a little bit more. The generative rules for relative clauses say that a clause is restrictive if it can only modify one or more noun phrases. No adjective phrases, unless they're inside another noun phrase, no verb phrases, no other types of phrases. But a non-restrictive clause can modify any type of phrase, including noun phrases, which is why if you find a relative clause modifying a noun phrase, you don't really know that much about it, because it could be either restrictive or non-restrictive. So it's for these reasons, because those rules, come on, they're pretty complicated, can modify any kind of phrase, cannot modify this, and so forth. Those are pretty complicated. That's why grammar is an art and not a science. If it was a science, Microsoft Grammar Check wouldn't screw things up so badly and make my students actually make mistakes. You could just program in the scientific rules and bam, you get good, correct grammar checking. Instead, you get the mess that you get. So that covers phrases and clauses. Remember again that the phrase can't ever stand on its own. It doesn't have both a noun phrase and a verb phrase. It's just one of those smaller things, noun phrase, verb phrase, adjective phrase, prepositional phrase. The clause, somewhat bigger, but part of a larger sentence. Some sentences, of course, can only have one clause. But when you have more than one clause, you have either a complex sentence, where things are embedded underneath other things, or you have a compound sentence where things are right next to each other, and we're going to talk about that in the next lecture. And we've looked at how these two different kinds of clauses, independent and dependent, and then later on, restrictive and non-restrictive, help us understand the different ways we need to present material to the reader. Okay, why do we care about that stupid which that distinction? It's basically stupid, but if you use it correctly, and if your reader knows about it, and actually even if they don't know about it, they'll just subconsciously get the distinctions that you are making. That only one of the red pandas was cute, for example, or only one of them was sleeping. Or, they're all cute, and they're all sleeping. So those are significant because what you're trying to do with your writing and your grammar is not just impress people with how grammatical you are, but actually communicate clearly to them. And some of these distinctions that seem sort of arbitrary, I, me, who, whom, which, and that, if you get them right, they actually communicate more clearly. If you use the right thing in the object case, then it's naturally the object and the person recognizes who is receiving the action. If you use your relative clauses properly, your restrictive and non-restrictive clauses, you can be clear about what your meaning in the sentence is. So these things are actually very valuable, even though they do seem sometimes petty or splitting hairs. They're not stupid like the split infinitive. These actually have a bearing on whether or not your reader understands you as clearly as you would like. So I don't want anyone to become like the unnamed professor with his going after every which that distinction in the world and saying, oh, really, excuse me, my colleagues, I would like to suggest that that should be which and not that. And everyone sighs, and he wasn't right on one of those two. And I will say I kept my mouth shut because I didn't want to have a fight about it. But I did edit it later because I was the recording secretary. So, ha, whoever writes the rules last gets to put in the commas is my rule. So we've done just about everything we need to do with phrases and clauses on their own. Now we're ready to move on to the punctuation that we use to mark off the clauses and help us clearly communicate our ideas to our readers. However, there is one little grammar and punctuation bit that I want to squeeze into the last minute or so of this lecture, because it doesn't really fit anywhere else. It really bothers people, and it will be useful to you. So it doesn't quite go with clauses and phrases, but you still want to know this anyway. This little tidbit arises out of the process of nominalization. Remember, we take a whole sentence and stuff it into a noun phrase, and the morphophonemic rules of English. But really, just think of it as a little grammatical bonus. Bonus. People sometimes worry, when they worry about their grammar, about their use of apostrophes. Apostrophes seem to be what set Lynn Truss off in Eats, Shoots, and Leaves book. I mean, she hates it when people misuse apostrophes. I mentioned before, she suggested that she would like to go around London with an apostrophe on a stick, holding it in front of signs where it's needed, and then another, like, blank thing to cover up ones that aren't needed. I mean, this is how strongly this woman feels about the apostrophe. So, in the interest of her not having to increase her medication dosage, let me give you a couple quick rules about the apostrophes. Now, the first thing is that apostrophes are marks that something is being left out. That's what they're for. Don't think that they indicate possession and stuff like that. Save that for a second. The original use of the apostrophe is to indicate that something is being left out. Think of don't or can't or won't. In each case, we use an apostrophe there to say we have left a letter or more letters out of something. This is really important. Now, again, for contractions like don't and couldn't, this never seems to be a problem. People have no issue. They stick the apostrophe in. They've memorized it. They might even think what they're contracting. They have no problem doing that. But it's less obvious that something is being taken out when we use an apostrophe to indicate possession. When we say the panda's tail, you think, yes, you put apostrophe S on the end of the word, indicates panda's tail. But you're leaving something out. Now, I'll admit, some scholars argue about this. Truss gets it wrong in her book, I think. See, I have my obnoxious English professor medievalist hat on right now. I think she gets it wrong in her book, but it's actually very simple. We're leaving something out of the apostrophe S, and what we're leaving out is a very, very old E. Let me explain. In Old English, with the inflected language, remember you had different endings that you stuck on words to indicate possession, to indicate location, and so forth. You had what's called the genitive case. This is the possessive case. And the genitive singular in Old English for the vast majority of nouns was ES. So, if we were deciding in Anglo-Saxon to have a discussion about King Alfred's hemorrhoids, and surprisingly people in Anglo-Saxon studies discuss King Alfred's hemorrhoids quite frequently, more than you would imagine, we would say something like Alfred Kuninge's hemorrhoids. I'm not sure. I think that the Anglo-Saxon word for hemorrhoid is pilus. It's a Latin word for piles, but I don't think we really want to go too far with that. Just to point out that the ES is the possessive ending. So you wouldn't say kings, you would say Kuninges, ES. That indicates a possessive ending. That ES to indicate possessive comes down to Chaucer and into the Middle English period. But instead of saying Kuninges, so they drop the unstressed vowel, the Kuninges, the E in there, and just say Kunings. And they represent the missing E with an apostrophe. And that's where you get your apostrophe S. It's indicating that the ending should be ES in the genitive singular, but you've lost that E. Now, there are some actual sensible people who argue against this. They're pointing out some problems in the philology and in the sound changes. I personally don't find those arguments convincing, which is why I'm saying Lynn Truss is wrong. The argument is instead that maybe you use the entire word his as your genitive ending or as your marker of possession. So you'd be saying, like, the king, his hemorrhoids, and then using the apostrophe to indicate two things missing there. Maybe, maybe not. For our purposes, it actually doesn't matter, but I will say that as a philologist, I don't buy it. I don't think it's the king, his hemorrhoids. I think it's the Kuninges hemorrhoids. So, here's where the drought way of grammar comes in. Something seems completely arbitrary, like using apostrophe S for both possession and for contractions. But it turns out that when we've studied it more, it's completely consistent. It's simply showing that things are missing. And it's even more consistent for what is perhaps the most annoying thing about English, and the one thing I most frequently mark on my student papers, and that's the confusion of its and its. One of these means it is. The other means belonging to it, and only one of them has an apostrophe. That's the one it is. It, apostrophe S, is a contraction for it is. And that's why we should not use the apostrophe when making it into a possessive. Why? Because nothing's been dropped. Nothing's been cut out. It's was never it as. It was always just it's. It's one unit. Nothing dropped out, so there's no reason for an apostrophe. But of course this is wildly confusing, because we think apostrophe S equals possession. Possession belonging to it. I'm going to put an apostrophe S on there. I mean, that's what any sensible person would do if the apostrophe S were a complete unit. But it's really not. It's marking something that isn't there anymore. And since that thing that isn't there never was there with its is just one word. So I always write on my student's paper, IT apostrophe S only ever means it is. But this is a losing battle. This is a battle I would like to win, and it's certainly something that Microsoft Grammar Check always flags and thing that you would like to do right, but it's very difficult. I mean, I did propose at one point that my students should have tattooed on their left wrist, IT apostrophe S only ever means it is. Learn it, love it, live it, but they didn't go for that. But if you do try to learn it, love it, live it, and follow just that rule, that IT apostrophe S never ever means possession, then you won't make that error. It's trivial. It's not like a sign of a, you know, great defect. But in the end, it really is one of the ones that's wrong, and it's absolutely wrong, and you can't change it. So at least knowing that the apostrophe marks something missing will help. Okay, so now I've imparted this little bit of wisdom and perhaps ranty goodness. And more important, you understand phrases and clauses. We're now ready to move on to the only thing that most people really care about phrases and clauses, which is how to punctuate them. And what could be more fun than an entire lecture on punctuation? Nothing, of course. Well, except maybe donuts, but I don't get to lecture about them. So let's move on to punctuation, pause and effect.
This ends Lecture 12.